everyone, Dan Cassidy here, and welcome to UBS On Air. On today's podcast, we are going to discuss COVID-19 and the race for a vaccine with UBS Asset Management. I am pleased to welcome Tom Dignan. Tom is an equity investment specialist, as well as Matt Konosky, lead portfolio manager for UBS Asset Management's healthcare and biotech portfolios. Tom, I know you're going to lead today's conversation with Matt. I'm looking forward to hearing it. Let me go ahead and pass it over to you, Tom. Welcome.
Great. Thanks, Dan. And, you know, I really appreciate you having both of us on today. You know, I'm lucky enough to have the opportunity to speak with Matt on this topic multiple times a week. Matt's been our lead PM for our healthcare and our biotech portfolios for several years, and he's truly an expert when it comes to all things COVID. Now, given the fast-growing and dynamic nature of healthcare in general, we decided to launch the healthcare and biotech portfolios for UBS Wealth Management clients via separately managed accounts. So it's very exciting that investors can now harness these growth opportunities in their portfolios. Now, I know there are a lot of burning questions we're all asking every day when it comes to our current state and when we'll start to see some normalcy. So let's jump right into some of the top things we've focused on recently. Now, Matt, let's first dive into the question everyone wants an answer to. What is your outlook for the world finding a COVID-19 vaccine? And then how soon could one be available?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. So at last count, nearly 50 vaccines were undergoing human testing worldwide. However, for purposes of this conversation, I'll focus on the five or six lead candidates that are in late stage testing. The two most advanced programs are the mRNA vaccines being developed by Pfizer in partnership with the German biotech company BioNTech, as well as Moderna. Both of these programs are in very large 30 to 40,000 patient trials, which are beginning to approach the point at which we could begin to expect an interim readout. So while there's been some concern recently about these trials taking longer to read out than originally forecast, thereby suggesting the vaccines might be less efficacious than originally hoped, I think this is an incorrect conclusion. Drug development is inherently very complex, and many considerations go into when or if to stop a trial. So as a result, I remain cautiously optimistic that one or both of these vaccines will be able to demonstrate the desired 70%+ efficacy and support a filing for FDA emergency use authorization by mid to late November. So recall, we already know both of these vaccine candidates generate robust antibody responses, which appear very comparable or higher than the levels that are found in individuals who have recovered from actual COVID infections. What we're trying to prove now is whether or not these antibodies are protective against future viral exposures. It'll likely take until middle of 2021 for FDA to grant either or both of these vaccines formal regulatory approval, but both are being manufactured at risk. So we should have enough doses to vaccinate 50 million or more higher risk individuals by calendar year end. So think about healthcare workers, frontline workers, even select portions of the elderly population, such as nursing home residents. And shortly after these mRNA readouts, we're expecting data from a second cohort of vaccines, including the viral vector programs, which are being developed by the likes of Oxford University with AstraZeneca, a Chinese biotech CanSino, as well as Johnson & Johnson. However, here there's been some recent enrollment pauses on at least two of these programs that might cause these timelines to slip into the new year. And then a bit further out, we have yet another wave of readouts from more established vaccine players like GlaxoSmithKline, Sanofi, Aventis, and Merck, as well as some startups such as Novavax. And while it's unlikely that this third set of vaccines will be widely available until mid to late next year, these are very important backups, which could importantly prove more durable than some of the early vaccines and be very important as we think about eventual revaccination efforts. So I guess the key takeaway here is that we don't have all of our eggs in any one basket. There are obviously a lot of unknowns, and that's obviously weighing on investor sentiment, but all indications today really point to a vaccine becoming available in at least limited quantities by calendar year end, with broader vaccination efforts to follow over 2021.
Well, you know, that's great, but you mentioned, you know, both the Oxford and J&J vaccines, and there have been media reports of clinical holds on those programs due to safety issues. So how concerned should we be on these safety signals? And I guess even more importantly, How will we know that these vaccines will really be safe upon approval?
So in the current environment, there's obviously been a lot of concern that the lead vaccine candidates are being advanced too quickly through the development process. And as a result, we've seen a lot of different surveys out suggesting that a not insignificant portion of the population, particularly lower risk individuals, might either put off being vaccinated or perhaps not even seek vaccination at all. What I would say is it's not at all surprising to see safety signals in a clinical trial setting. After all, this is why we run the clinical trials in the first place. And the two programs which experience these enrollment pauses, the Oxford vaccine and the Johnson & Johnson programs, both belong to the same class of drugs known as viral vector vaccines. Yes, these were rare but serious side effects, but they have very little to no read-through to the other vaccine programs, which are based off complete different platforms or technologies. And more importantly, after an exhaustive review by outside experts, both FDA and European regulators have allowed both of these programs to resume enrollment late last week. And this should put both programs back on track for an early 2021 readout, assuming no further issues arise. And if anything, this overabundance of caution only increases my confidence that the data safety monitoring role is functioning as it's intended and is not being influenced by any of these external political pressures, as some people may be feared. However, just in full disclosure, it is important to remember that all of these vaccine developers are working on extremely compressed timelines. These COVID vaccines will be approved with much less clinical data than is typical for any new vaccine. And so it's really crucial to maintain the utmost level of transparency throughout the process to preserve the public's trust. And it also is going to make sense once these vaccines become available to prioritize higher risk individuals for initial vaccinations. This will give us yet another opportunity to generate additional safety data before we open things up and expand vaccination programs to lower risk populations, such as younger individuals and children. And ultimately, only with the passage of time will we know the really true safety profile of these vaccines, but nothing that I've seen to date really appears overly concerning.
All right, well, that's great news. But how long will it take to achieve broad-scale vaccination in the U.S. so we can get back to normal?
So COVID-19 will very likely be with us for many years to come. However, we don't need to completely eradicate the virus in order to return to something at least resembling normal. Really, what the goal here is to have 60 or 70% of the general population have robust antibody levels, either because they've recovered from an active COVID infection, or because they've been vaccinated. And this will allow us to very significantly reduce viral transmission rates. Today, estimates suggest that about 15% of the U.S. population has already been exposed to COVID-19. And while not everyone will have generated the necessary immune response, a very significant portion of this will. So as a result, we likely only need to vaccinate another 50% of the population to reach this 60 to 70% threshold. A few months ago, my base case for reaching this level would have probably been late fall, maybe even early winter of 2021. But to date, things have moved along a bit faster than I would have expected. And as of today, aside from the slight enrollment pauses on the viral vector programs, we haven't encountered any major bumps in the vaccine development process. So I think my timeline would be pulled forward slightly, and I think kind of late summer or very early fall of next year is a realistic timeline. Now, initially, vaccine manufacturing capacity is going to be the limiting factor, but this will begin to overcome this by late spring. At that point, the challenge will shift more to the complex logistics of getting these doses to where they need to be, ultimately using kind of ultra cold chain storage, at least for the first generation program. And while vaccine doses in short supply initially, there's going to be transportation challenges for these. These are going to be a non-trivial task. And we're also going to need to overcome just human inertia and make sure that individuals receive the necessary two doses of these vaccines on schedule. While many people will likely be eager to step forward to get vaccinated, there may be individuals who hold back. And in the end, until we can get to this 60 or 70% threshold in late summer, in my view, we are likely to see some regional virus flare-ups. None of these things, importantly, are really insurmountable, but it is going to require a level of coordination at the federal, state, and local level that to date has been a challenge. One final point just to put out there, and that's very important to consider, is that we don't know how long these vaccines are going to provide protection or exactly what level of antibodies are required to confer immunity. Kind of, it's going to take some time to answer these questions, and really, that's going to be very informative to what, if any, revaccination requirements there are for these programs.
Well, you know, I hate to even bring this up, but what if something goes wrong and it takes longer than anticipated to have vaccines broadly available?
So vaccines are obviously a very important part of the effort to return to normal, but fortunately, they're not our only shot on goal here. There are many other important medical advances that are occurring that are completely independent of the vaccine development efforts that we've been talking about here. For starters, while these are not necessarily game changers, the FDA has already approved an antiviral remdesivir, as well as convalescent plasma generated from the blood donations of COVID survivors. These are very important rescue treatments that we frankly didn't have several months ago. An even more interesting approach are these monoclonal antibodies that are being developed by Regeneron, Eli Lilly, as well as a couple of other companies. These are basically synthetic versions of the antibodies that are generated by the immune system and, in theory, can be used both in a preventive setting or perhaps even as a rescue therapy in a post-exposure setting. And these can provide a very crucial bridge through this winter until we have the vaccines more widely available early to mid-next year. Combined this with therapies to manage the hyperactive immune response that some patients with COVID experience, and I think we will see a declining case fatality rate as long as we don't overwhelm our hospital system. And while the initial jump in cases is resulting in higher absolute numbers of hospitalizations, outside of a few areas of the country, we aren't really approaching a level that in my view threatens to overrun our hospitals. More importantly, hospitals are making a lot of significant strides in learning how to operate in a post-COVID world. This is allowing them to continue to perform many elective and urgent medical procedures and avoid kind of the wholesale deferral of care that we saw kind of back in late March and April.
Well, you know, as always, I love talking to you, Max. I feel like I get a science lesson, which I need. But let's pivot to the investment front. What's the outlook for healthcare given two things, with the ongoing pandemic combined with the upcoming presidential election?
So despite being very well insulated from the COVID-related demand shocks that are impacting many other sectors of the economy, healthcare's relative valuation versus the S&P has been depressed by typical election year volatility. In our view, this creates a really compelling risk-reward. Although healthcare often trades poorly heading into a presidential election, it typically outperforms post-election as the resulting policy changes prove less draconian and less dramatic than people feared going in. While the prospect of maybe not knowing the actual election results right away adds an additional wrinkle, I really think that healthcare should fare well under either a Democratic or a Republican administration. Simply don't expect ACA repeal efforts to succeed. And at the same time, I don't believe there is enough public or political support for a real true public option, even in the most extreme case of a Democratic sweep. Instead, I think the political efforts kind of post-election are going to focus on expanding coverage through Medicaid, possibly lowering the Medicare eligibility age, which is going to be bullish for overall healthcare demand. There will likely be some efforts aimed at drug pricing reform, but I think the biopharma industry will be well positioned to weather these changes. And I think that at the end of the day, the U.S. health system is going to continue to pay for innovation. And as for COVID, we believe it'll be some time before the virus is reduced to levels seen with other infectious disease. So as a result, I think there's going to be a long tail of demand for vaccination and diagnostic testing lasting well into 2022. And this is going to be another tailwind for overall healthcare demand. So bottom line, I think the current disconnect between valuations and fundamentals in healthcare is unwarranted, and see healthcare as being a relative outperformer as we move post-election into the kind of post-COVID vaccine world.
Well, I want to say thank you, Matt. It's always great to hear your insights, and it is going to be a really interesting path ahead, and we'll have to see how that path continues to evolve within the investment landscape. And then just to reiterate, we believe at Asset Management that healthcare and biotech are fast-growing and attractive in a portfolio context. The new separately managed accounts we offer for these strategies provide a great way to get a direct exposure to them. And Dan, thank you again for having us on the show today, and look forward to continuing the conversation over the next several months.
Well, Tom and Matt, thank you again for joining us and for providing timely insights into the healthcare and biotech spaces, as well as where we stand with respect to the race for a COVID-19 vaccine. The conversation, of course, will continue, so we'll look forward to having you join us again soon.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory service in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, different in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that clients understand the ways in which we conduct business, that they carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to them about the products or services we offer. A small number of our financial advisors are not permitted to offer advisory services to you and can only work with you directly as UBS broker-dealer representatives. Your financial advisor will let you know if this is the case, and if you desire advisory services, we will be happy to refer you to another financial advisor who can help you. Our agreements and disclosures will inform you about whether we and our financial advisors are acting in our capacity as an investment advisor or broker-dealer. For more information, please review the PDF document at ubs.com/relationship summary.